Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight is Tuesday, May 31st, 2022, and our call-in number is 347-857-3293. And this is Ralph Pointer of What's Happening, Blog Talk Radio. And tonight we're asking a question. Does anyone know the relationship between gun control and crack cocaine legislation? We'll deal with that a little later. Right now, this program is about an anatomy of oppression, which requires an anatomy of colonialism and imperialism. And we are specifically focusing on the American capitalist system. And this entire program is dedicated to the plight of our political prisoners. And Ralph Pointer, what's happening?
Good evening, my brothers and sisters. As usual, there is so much to say and so little time to say it. As Sister Betty has talked, has introduced the program, as we plan way in advance, what is the relationship between gun control and crack cocaine legislation, the Rockefeller laws in New York, etc.? We would like to talk about that. We'll talk about it tonight, maybe. We'll talk about it tomorrow on our program on Pacifica 99.5 on your radio dial at 8 p.m. But more important, with gladness, and sadness. I want to celebrate the release of Sundiata Okola from the death camps that is reserved for political resistors in America that we call political prisoners, justifiably that we call political prisoners. And I'm reminded of a letter that Sundiata Okola wrote to Lynn Stewart many, many years ago. And this letter gladdens and saddens me because what he said, and he said it better, I should have it in front of me now, he said the faith that political prisoners have that the people will free them as will make the religious philosophy or those who believe in religion pale. Their belief would pale in comparison with the belief of our political prisoners have in the people. And in those terms, like I said, I'm glad Sundiata is out, but I must say, in all honesty, we, the people, have failed miserably in living up to that faith. We can't even get a vote. We can't get people to call a representative. And above all, we have not created or encouraged more people to resist this government. And but I'm going to let it go with that. If we get time after we say, welcome home, Sundiata, we will discuss that. And we have special guests, and we've been told that they do not have a lot of time, and so we're going to skip over our usual format of having prose or poetry to honor many people, and we're going to go right to Jill Elijah.
But we will be returning to that format. Attorney Jill
Elijah. Attorney Jill Elijah. We go way back. Jill, your microphone is open.
And welcome.
Hi, good evening. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for attending, and in the honor of our brother, Sundiata. Speak, please.
Yes, well, I agree. It is a most joyful occasion and a people's victory that Sundiata is finally free after 49 years. It was clear that the New Jersey Parole Board intended for him to die in prison and that the only way we were going to get him out was through a protracted court battle and a people's campaign, both of which came together to result in a historical court decision that was released on May the 10th of this year, and Sundiata walked out of prison as a free man on May the 25th, just last week, just a little less than a week ago. And it was a most joyous occasion, to say the least.
Well, we all felt that. I listened to some of our other brothers and sisters talking on various talk shows, and so many people want to see him. But, you know, when our people are released from the death camps, they have so many restrictions, and we dare not run afoul of the restrictions with visitations and statements, as we all recognize or remember what happened up in Rochester when they tried to re-imprison our brother for, they claim, he tried to register the vote.
Right. You know, so, Ralph, I'd like to add to that. In addition to the restrictions, I hope that everybody will honor the fact that Sundiata and his family deserve every minute to just be together after such a long separation. He has the beautiful blessing of being able to have his daughters, his grandchildren, his nieces, and his older sister, and they need to have time to just smother him with love. it's true that all of his supporters and well-wishers want to spend time with him and also want to smother him, but I hope everybody will respect the fact that his family really comes first.
Yes, and it was made clear by his comrades in arms when they were speaking that they were going to wait to be contacted if that's possible. But we also would like to say to everyone, send your love in donations. I'm not sure the economic situation of Sundiata Okoli and his family, but I know so many of our brothers and sisters get out of the death camps and they are broke and they have no health. Please do.
Yes, Ralph, I'm glad that you raised that. I mean, I think it's probably impossible for any of us to imagine having no source of income for 50 years. And clearly at 85, he's not going to go out and get a job. And so all of his needs, his health needs in particular, he's had 50 years of medical neglect. And we all know how much it costs to get decent health care. So all of his needs have to be borne expense-wise by his family. So we're urging people to give and to give generously. So all the proceeds that are received are going to his family to care for him. And I'd be happy to give the website address where people can donate. May I do that now?
Would you please do it twice, loud and clear?
Loud and clear. Sundiata Okoli, F for Freedom, C for Campaign, Sundiata Okoli, FC.org. Again, SUNDIATAACOLIFC.org. You go to the website, the donate button is right on the homepage, and we ask people to give from the heart, understanding that these are the funds that his family is going to need to take care of him, literally for the rest of his life.
Yes, and we're hoping that it will be a long life, but we know the prison system. When our dear sister Lynn got out, it was 2 months and 7 days before we were able to take her to a hospital to deal with her cancer that had spread. So Sundiata, I'm sure, is in the same position. And so, as you say, tell us one more time, and I want everyone on this program to put it on their personal website. Get it out there. We must flood him with money because that's what it's going to take to have a reasonably a decent remainder of his life. One more time, Jill Elijah, attorney who worked so hard on this situation, who worked so hard on so many of the political prisoners, one more time so that we get it right.
Okay. It's Sundiata Okoli, FC. I'll spell it. SUNDIATAACOLI, F for Freedom, C for Campaign, .org. And Ralph,
well,
I just wanted to clarify for your audience, I don't want people to listen and think that we're saying that Sundiata has cancer. He does not have cancer. I understand the similarities you were drawing with respect to Lynn and her health. You know, I know that situation well, too. Sundiata has a number of health complications. Cancer, fortunately, is not one of them, but he definitely needs extensive health care, and we're hoping to get him quality health care as soon as possible.
Just a minute.
Jill Elijah, again, thank you for getting on. But you are wearing several hats these days. I think you have another group of prisoners that you focus on and try to organize. Could you tell us the name of your organization?
Certainly. Thank you. I run an organization, a nonprofit that's a New York statewide organization headquartered in Harlem called the Alliance of Families for Justice. And the mission of the organization is to support, empower, and mobilize families who have incarcerated loved ones and people who are justice involved, whether they're incarcerated or formerly incarcerated. remarshal their political and voting power to bring about systemic change.
All righty. Thank you.
All kinds of services.
Right. And this is what is necessary, as you say, not only for Sundiata, but for so many of our people. Sister Betty.
Is there a website you want to mention so that people can perhaps refer people to you or support you? I know you organize a lot of protests on behalf of people trapped in the death camps.
Certainly. Our website is afj-ny.org. So if people want to know more about what Alliance of Families for Justice does, our services, all of which are free, they can go to our website. But most importantly, tonight, I hope that people will generously support Sundiata and his family as they welcome him home.
Thank you so much for that. And I know our people, our comrades, are going to take all of your words to heart. Sister Betty.
All right. Well, at this point, we want to thank our comrade, Jill Elijah. We recognize that these have been stressful moments, and she is understandably regrouping her strength. And so we don't want to impose any further. At this time, she's more than welcome to listen. But we're going to continue with our regular program. And Brother Ralph, what's happening?
Well, there's so much happening, as I say. It's very difficult to cover under normal circumstances. But the things that are happening so fast that are so dangerous to our people at home and abroad. At home, we know what the story is. And the situation in Ukraine puts a clear light on that. We see billions, trillions of dollars going to Ukraine, and just as in every situation, every war that America embarks on, that is the excuse for not putting money and effort into justice at home. We have homelessness here in New York. We have every problem that oppressed people are confronted with. We have every political problem in our inability to express ourselves at the voting polls. We have gerrymandering. And our party, some people call it our party, our president. Some people call him our president. Our presidents, so-called presidents, and we have to give Elijah Muhammad credit for that term, so-called our presidents have done nothing about it or very little. And we see when we get the power of the vote, then they gerrymander it without real fighting, without real intention of changing it by the party that we have supported over the years. And so we see in Colombia, and I'm saddened by the fact that the left-wing candidate didn't win on the first ballot, because what happened is the same as in Europe. It's the same as in NATO. The European imperial right-wing organizations gather together to fight any change, to fight anyone who has been the source of change. And we see in Colombia, the two right-wing parties already are supporting each other to overcome the left-wing or the progressive vote in Colombia. And to end my part of this conversation, I say, remember Allende in Chile. It has to be more than the vote, as Fidel Castro warns us, as Che Guevara warns us, that it is only one instrument of our struggle for liberation. And our role here is to try to get education and understanding to our people, no, to all people, the necessity of changing the direction of the American empire. Sister Betty.
All right. You've heard the beginning. There is a lot going on, as you know, but we're going to go back to our format, and we will go call on our poet in residence, who, as usual, is a former political prisoner. And, comrade, your mic is open. Thank you for joining. Thank you for being patient with the delay.
778.
Hello.
We hear you loud and clear.
Yes, yes. I have a very good, pretty short poem here by Asada that I want to read. But I would just, before I do it, let me just underline and reemphasize the words spoken about Brother Sundiata Kohli. Let me just briefly give you a little situation that I actually went through. In the late 1980s, after many years of trials, I finally hit Leavenworth Penitentiary. And as I stepped into that death camp, and that's certainly the right name for it, I was greeted by two comrades. I was greeted by Leonard Peltier, and I was greeted by Sundiata Kohli. Of course, they embraced me, and they put me down with you know, the situation, what's going on, and so forth, that political prisoners do when new comrades enter. And at that time, Sundiata had already done over 15 years. Leonard had already done over 12 years in prison. And so we see Sundiata coming out now, 49 years. A man is 85 years old. And I would just like to ask people to think, perhaps they got a grandfather, a father, a granduncle or something like that. Think of people that you know that are 85 years old. Think of their situation health-wise, overall, you know, in terms of diet and diseases and so forth. And then imagine that individual spending 49 years in the worst, most hellish conditions and realities that exist on this whole earth, the American prison system, and walking out 85 years old, but still walking, still principled, still knowledgeable. And so that's why we have to do everything we can. And I really emphasize that, as has already been said, we need to support him in a direct, financial, real way. And so with that thought in mind, let me quickly share this very good poem. And this is by Asada. And the name of it is "No One Can Stop the Rain." She begins by saying, "Watch, the grass is growing. Watch, but don't make it obvious. Let your eyes roam casually, but watch. In any prison yard, you can see it growing. In the cracks, in the crevices, between the steel and the concrete, out of the dead gray dust. The bravest blades of grass shoot up, bold and full of life. Watch, the grass is growing, growing through the cracks. The guards say grass is against the law. Grass is contraband in prison. The guards say that the grass is insolent. It is uppity grass, radical grass, militant grass, terrorist grass. They call it weed, nasty weed, nigger weed, dirt, spit, savage Indian, wetback, pinko, commie weed, subversive. And so the guards try to wipe out the grass. They yank it from the roots. They poison it with drugs. They maul it. They rake it. Blades of grass have been found hanging in cells, covered with bruises, quote unquote, apparent suicide. The guards say the grass is not authorized. Do not let the grass grow. You can spy on the grass. You can lock up the grass. You can mow it down temporarily. You will never keep it from growing. Watch. The grass is beautiful. The guards try to mow it down, but it keeps on growing. The grass grows into a poem. The grass grows into a song. The grass paints itself across the canvas of life. And the picture is clear, and the lyrics are true, and the haunting voices sing so sweet and strong that the people hear the grass from far away. And the people start to dance, and the people start to sing. And the song is freedom. Watch, the grass is growing.
Right on. The picture is clear, and the spirit is true. And wonderful, wonderful prose and poetry. It's inspiring, and it entertains the intellect and the soul. Thank you so much for that. Sister Betty.
Without further ado, before we go to our political prisoner update, we've had some good news, but we've also had some very, very distressing news, and we want the Jericho people who are in the house to help us understand it. So Boston Jericho, New York City Jericho, please bear with us. We have a special guest. I think many of you know we've had this wonderful guest on before. He's also a strong advocate for political prisoners, but he's also a strong advocate for the truth of history. And I always say, I never say teach black history. I always say just teach the truth of history, and we are all over it. So without further ado, Dr. Kelly Harris of Seton Hall University, thank you for coming back, and welcome. Your mic is open.
Well, Sister Betty and Brother Ralph, thank you both for having me. It's always an honor to join you and join your audience and to learn from you as much as I try to share anything with you and your audience. And I just want to give a heartfelt thank you to the brother who just spoke and shared his testimony about Brother Sundiata. And I want to, kind of extend what he said, because I think what he said was very powerful. To think about Brother Sundiata and other political prisoners that we have to understand, people made serious sacrifices, and we have to understand that. That's not easy to do. It's not easy for people just to, sacrifice their job, let alone putting their life on the line for principles and values and trying to really liberate us and free us. People make those sacrifices not only for themselves but for their family, for their children's children, for other families that they don't know, locally, nationally, and internationally. And Brother Sundiata did that. He paid a heavy price. And when we think about it, people who are activists out here, people who organize, you know very well that you have families, and you have families that don't do the work that you do, but they love you, and they miss you. They don't understand everything that we do. But Sundiata was stripped away from his family, his loved ones, and we have to do all that we can really to lift him up and to provide support for him. So I want to thank the brother again for his comment. They were very much on time, and I want to reiterate that we need to do all that we can for people who committed themselves to a higher principle and paid the ultimate sacrifice. So we need to understand that. And when we do that, it's not to disparage or spit on the grave of Officer Warner Foster, because we do have humanity, but it was a war, and we have to understand that, and we feel for his family and their loss, but it was a war, and Brother Sundiata, Sister Asada, Brother Zahid Shakur, they were political prisoners, and they were fighting in a war, and we have to understand that, and we have to teach our people that. So with that said, I would like to talk about Memorial Day that just passed. And I want to share an excellent work for your audience who are interested. The best work I've seen talking about it is actually a chapter in a book. But the book is by David Blight. It's called Race and Reunion, and it deals with Civil War in American history. And David Blight's an excellent historian. His most recent work was a piece on a biography on Frederick Douglass. But this book, Race and Reunion, he put out almost over 20 years ago. But he has a chapter in there called Decoration Days. And in that chapter, he describes the roots of Memorial Day. Now, when we think about Memorial Day now, of course, we're celebrating, people celebrate veterans of all the wars in this country's history. And it really has become associated, it really is, for lack of a better word, seen as a white holiday, even though there are black veterans. We don't embrace it. We don't talk about this. The roots of it are not seen to be black. Well, we need to talk about that and discuss that, and that's what Blight does. So August 13th, 1861, that's when the Civil War began at Fort Sumter in Charleston, South Carolina. So in Charleston, South Carolina, in March, April, and May of 1865, at the end of the Civil War, black people were celebrating in Charleston, South Carolina. And they were celebrating for particular reasons. One, because it had a lot of symbolic significance, because that was the beginning of the Civil War. That was the location of the beginning of the Civil War. So black people in March of 1865 had organized celebrations to not only celebrate the end of the Civil War, but in their mind, the end of chattel slavery. They had another one in March. Then they had another celebration in April. In the April celebration, they had that on April 14th of that of 1865. Martin Delaney was at that celebration. Martin Delaney, who was considered by some the father of black nationalism in this country, who was the first black person to be conferred as a general in the Union Army, who was a peer of Frederick Douglass. Martin Delaney was one of our brilliant organizers, orators, scholars of the 19th century. He was there. William Lloyd Garrison, an abolitionist, was there. The son of Denmark Vesey was there. Why is that important? Denmark Vesey had planned a rebellion in 1822 in Charleston, South Carolina. So our people, when they're celebrating the end of the Civil War, said we also want to lift up and celebrate Denmark Vesey and what he tried to do in 1822. So they were extending that. That's why memory is so important. What is it that we remember? What is it that we call on? Our forefathers and foremothers in the 19th century, they called on the Haitian Revolution. They called on the slave rebellions, of whether it was the successful one of Nat Turner or whether it was the planned ones of a Denmark Vesey. They read David Walker and uplifted David Walker. So we have to remember those things. So black folk had in April were already celebrating, but it was May 1st, 1865, when the official Decoration Day is noted. And this becomes important because, again, it has a lot of symbolic significance. There was a race track, or what they called at that time a race course, in Charleston, South Carolina, where the white aristocracy would hold horse races, the rich white folk. But also at that track, during the Civil War, they held Union soldiers. It kept them in prison and unsanitary conditions, and over 200 of them died there. And they didn't take the time even to put grave marks on any of their graves. They just threw them in and buried them or whatever at that race course. So black people in Charleston, South Carolina, created over 10 days a covering to go over the race course so the bodies would be preserved and protected. They had burial services. They planted flowers and everything on May 1st to honor those who had fought in the Civil War, fought for black freedom, not just black soldiers, but Union soldiers, black, white, or otherwise. So they celebrated that. And when they celebrated, they had a march, and they marched to the song John Brown's Body. So, again, that particular historical memory becomes very important. John Brown, of Bleeding Kansas fame, of Harper's Ferry's fame, was very respected in the conscience of not only abolitionists, but black folk in the 19th century. So they marched to John Brown's body. And Blight says that when they were marching to John Brown's body, William Lloyd Garrison began to cry. So John Brown's body, and here's what becomes interesting. A few months after that, Julia Ward Howe, who was the wife of Samuel Gridley Howe. Samuel Gridley Howe is one of the Secret Six who helped John Brown, who helped fund him and who helped assist him in planning the raid on Harper's Ferry. So Samuel Gridley's wife, Julia Ward Howe, remixed John Brown's body. She wrote some other lyrics to it, remixed it, same tune, but remixed it. That remix became the Battle Hymn of the Republic. So the Battle Hymn of the Republic was initially John Brown's body. So the Battle Hymn of the Republic and Memorial Day have their roots in the black struggle for freedom in this country. And that's something that we should never forget, because oftentimes when black people are rightfully protesting and criticizing American hypocrisy and fighting for justice, not only for political prisons, but fighting for justice and universal freedom for everybody. When we do that, there are often people who say, well, if you don't like the country, then you should just leave, then go somewhere else. But they often forget that much of what makes this country great in different ways, what makes this country great really is the protest tradition, the tradition of people fighting for justice and equality, fighting for a free and fair education and excellent education for everybody, fighting for health care for everybody. So fighting to eradicate unjust systems and racism and classism and sexism, we are at the forefront of that. So we are the ones who should be pointing to people and telling them, well, maybe you should go somewhere else. Because when you think about the traditions in this country, whether it be Memorial Day, whether it be the Battle Hymn of the Republic, whether it be other celebrations and other things about this country, it goes back to the roots of the Black struggle for freedom. And that's my two cents.
Well, thank you so much for that. And as I tell people all of the time, this program is archived. You can listen to it again and again, and I love it because I learn so much from the guests that we have, the participants at teaching. Thank you so much for that.
Again, I want to say this is one of our special guests on WBAI, and there's a special convention, I think, that's coming up soon. That he's working well on, I think, collaboration with certain political forces in New Jersey. Did you want to make that announcement before we go on to the next speaker, Doctor?
Well, yes. Yeah. So in August, there will be the 50th anniversary of the Gary Convention. It will be hosted in Newark, New Jersey. Mayor Raz Baraka and Mayor Chokwe Lumumba Jr. from Jackson, Mississippi are co-hosting it. It will be in New Jersey. So we encourage people to attend. It'll be over 3 days in August. We already hosted at Seton Hall a model Gary convention for New Jersey public schools. T.J. Whitaker of the Maplewood South Orange Freedom Schools co-organized it with me, co-hosted it with me, and it was a success. And we have to come back and talk about that when we have more time. And we can get T.J. on there, maybe some of our students who come back and talk about that experience.
That will be fantastic. We look forward to it. And remember, we will be a part of that. We will announce it on every opportunity. Thank you, Dr. Kelly Harris.
Thank you so much.
All right. We always give a preference to our political prisoners, and we have a very special political prisoner on. So before we get our reports from Jericho that's in the house,
Al-Shuni Ali. One who knew, Sundiata, your microphone is open. Palau, your microphone.
Free the land, everybody. You can seek refuge in the law and being against misleading and being misled. Ask the law to guide my heart and to guide my tongue. I'm very happy to join the family this evening, and rejoicing over the fact that we got Brother Sundiata. You know, to have him out is a wonderful feeling to know that you know, although they're striking us hard, you know, we're striking back and winning back, and it's good to. Good to have Sundiata out here with us. It'd be good to study. I'd advise people to study the case of it's listed in the U.S. federal courts as USA versus Dr. Mutulu Shakur. And they have, Sundiata came to testify on our behalf in that case. And he came to testify on our behalf. And I remember the prosecutor trying to embarrass him and say that, asking, wasn't it right that he had, that he tried to escape from Marion Marion Prison, Illinois. And Sundiata, you know, reminded him that he did escape, that he didn't almost escape, that he did escape, and that, you know, it took him 20 minutes before they caught him and put him back in prison. And he said it was his duty to escape.
Well, I do remember that.
And he got a thunderous ovation, loud and standing.
And I thank you for joining us, because I...
The life of the revolutionary.
Well, thank you for, as I say, reminding us of that moment. I, too, was there to hear him answer. And so, as we wanted to have those who were closest to Sundiata, who were with him on the outside. Right. Thank you, Bilal Sunni Ali.
I know you are also supporting another one of our warriors who's still behind the walls of the death camp. Did you want to make a statement about that before you go?
Yes, I do. I just came back from Orlando, Florida, where we had the tournament, the Imam Jamil basketball tournament, as well as had a community dinner and a community banquet on Sunday. And just want to remind everybody that where the case is moving right now, legally, it's in front of the Conviction Integrity Unit. The Conviction Integrity Unit has the ability, they have the power to call for a retrial, to call for a new trial, or reduce a sentence, or to free and exonerate the person. So that's what we're asking. We're demanding that they free and exonerate Imam Jamil Al-Amin as soon as possible. And
well,
you know, it's a, you know, it's a story of someone can confess to the crime the very next morning, 4 days before Imam Jamil was apprehended, but still, it's been 22 years, and we haven't had a, and so this conviction unit is now in the process of saying that it is looking at the case of Imam Jamil, and it could only bring a positive result, free and exonerate him, and that's you know, that's what I want to remind people. They can go to the website www.imamjamilactionnetwork.org. www.imamjamilactionnetwork.org.
Thank you so much for that, Bilal Sunni Ali, and we hope that Anne will put it up on both of these messages, up on the Jericho website, so that it'll always be there. As I call the Jericho website my Bible, this is what I go to. This is the most important thing in my life, to free those who gave their lives for our community, for all communities. Sister Betty.
Thank you so much, Comrade Bilal. We are honored that you took the time from your busy schedule to chime in for our warrior who has returned to his family. Again, Sister Anne will probably repeat that information because she's always on top of it. And again, we thank you.
Thank you, Anne. Thank you, Betty.
Thank you, Bilal. Okay, good to hear from you. Good to hear your voice. Sister Betty.
All right, Jericho. Both your mics are open. As always, we are very happy that you are in the house. Comrade Ann, Comrade Kazi, go for it. Your mics are open.
I'm driving. So I just want to say I'm listening and feeling the grass, hearing the grass growing as I'm driving.
Cool.
So free tool. We got free tool, man. All
yeah.
right. Gotta get the tool now.
Thank you for that, Kazi Touré, Boston. Yes. Well, I guess you said it so well. You're feeling the grass growing. Sister Ann.
Yes. Okay. Always an honor, of course, to be in this exalted company. That was Imam Jamil, actionnetwork.org, in case you couldn't hear Bilal too well. And we are very helpful with this conviction integrity unit, because it would seem that only positive things could come from it. Of course, happy about Sundiata. We can reiterate once again, he needs support. His family needs support. Go to Sundiata, FC for freedomcampaign.org. Make a donation. You know, as Sophia Elijah clearly explained, his family is going to be needing funds for his ongoing medical care. The man is 85 years old. You know, he has various health conditions. He's also recovering from COVID. And we're very happy to have him with us, but we would have liked to have him with us much sooner, of course. But we are fighting the most horrible imperialist beast on the planet, right? Yet another senator.
All right. I believe you have an announcement, a special program that's coming up, an event.
Well, I wasn't going to announce an event, actually. I was going to announce the fact that yet another senator, Senator Mazie Hirono, who's a Democrat from Hawaii, is urging President Joe Biden to grant clemency to our friend and comrade Leonard Peltier. All right.
Oh, wonderful.
Around that, which is really good. That is continuing. So we already had several other senators do this, in addition to, of course, Pope Francis, the Dalai Lama, Nelson Mandela, Coretta Scott King, Amnesty International, indigenous leaders, members of Congress, various celebrities, Danny Glover, et cetera, right? So she is the third Democratic senator to personally appeal to Biden to grant clemency to Peltier in the last several months. First was Senator Patrick Leahy, the longest-serving senator and a former chairman of the Judiciary Commission. He told the Huffington Post in November, it's time for Leonard to go home. In February, he went on to publicly call on Biden to free him. Senator Brian Schatz, also from Hawaii, who chairs the Indian Affairs Committee, has also urged Biden to grant clemency to Peltier. So in a statement, a spokesperson for Hirono said the senator has long championed the rights of our country's indigenous communities and that her support for Leonard's release is a natural extension of those efforts. She is grateful to the advocates and media coverage that has shed further light on this issue in the recent months and decided to lend her name to the growing list of members of Congress who are calling for Mr. Peltier's sentence to be commuted. So that is a good thing. And in an interview from prison, Leonard recently told this young woman, Jennifer, from the Huffington Post, what he would say to Biden if he had him alone for 5 minutes. I'm not guilty of this shooting. I'm not guilty. I would like to go home to spend what years I have left with my great-grandkids and my people. So, you know, that's another thing that we have to be pushing. People should sign the petition for clemency for Leonard. They should sign the petition for clemency for Mutulu, Dr. Mutulu Shakur. They should follow up with the Imam Jamil Action Network and keep abreast of what is going on with our political prisoners, because as Bilal clearly stated, somebody else confessed to the so-called crime 4 days before they apprehended the imam. So, you know, clearly this is a total miscarriage of justice. And, of course, once again, we go back to the infamous and never-ending COINTELPRO. It has not died. It will never die. As long as there are people in this country who resist, there's always going to be COINTELPRO, no matter what they call it. So what's the call? Free them all. And it's on us to do it.
Well, thank you so much for that, Ann Lamb. Sister Betty.
All right. We have our man of the hour, Brother Henry Hagen. Your mic is open.
Hey.
Thank you, Sister Betty and Brother Ralph and all of our contributors.
I was astonished to learn several days ago about Rape of Haiti in an article series published by the New York Times entitled The Ransom. It says, "Invade Haiti," Wall Street urged, "and the U.S. obliged." And it describes the criminal role that the U.S. Marines were engaged in to loot the Haitian treasury and take that wealth back to the United States. And subsequent administrations and military interventions in Haiti facilitated the theft of Haiti's wealth, both the agricultural wealth and the financial wealth that it had accrued through its efforts. The ransom was issued on May 20th of this year, a few days ago, and it was updated on the 26th. And I was astonished to learn, but then as you think about it, not so much, that First National Citibank urged the government to loot Haiti over the last few centuries. Last couple of centuries and change. I also was astonished to learn that the Eiffel Tower in France, in Paris, was in part financed by the theft of resources from Haiti. And it's a world-famous attraction that is elegant in its appearance, but the sweat and blood of the Haitian people helped finance its construction, which is an abomination in effect. Dr. Gerald Horn has written a book entitled Confronting Black Jacobins that further illuminates the terrible treatment that Haiti was subjected to because it fought for and won its independence not only from France but from England and Spain at various times in its history. But I would urge people to pick up this series published in the New York Times. It's called The Ransom, Invade Haiti, Wall Street Urged, the U.S. Obliged. And to this day, Haiti is still being subjected to United States terrorism. And this has to end. And what they feared most was Haiti's example, quoting Fidel, when they talk about, you know, heroic examples and people rising up, especially people of African descent, and successfully throwing out the oppressors. So, again, I would urge people to pick up that series in the Times, on the Internet, to read and understand that the wealth of the United States is stolen, and it continues to be stolen from Haiti. And if each successive administration has made sure that Haiti never rises above the conditions that they've rendered to it. And this must not be acceptable. So I want to thank everybody for the opportunity to share that information with you.
Thank you so much, Brother Henry. Education, education, education. Educating ourselves. Reminded of their struggle because the first three presidents of the United States, when they were out of office, sent money to the land growers and the slavers in Haiti, the European and French slavers, to support their struggle against the revolution. And so this is the root of American slavery. This is the root of the position of the political position of this country. Sister Betty.
We have quite a list of people, so we've extended the program. But if I may, I beg the patience of my comrades to remind you that when we talk about what does colonialism mean, when you hear Brother Henry Higgins discuss the rape of Haiti, you have a perfect textbook description
of colonialism. And that anatomy of oppression is repeated all over the world. So we are so grateful that all of you understand this. And all of you have heard me say time and time again, don't label it Black history. Just demand that they put everybody's history in, and we will be all over it. And that's what Dr. Kelly is showing you. But the role of the American capitalist system is to destroy your sense of what's real. And if you don't know history, you will never have a true perspective on what's really going on. And we're talking about the rape of the funds and the resources of Haiti. We want to switch to one of our warriors, our working class warriors, who's trying to organize us to stop the rape at home of our resources, namely our public education money. She is demanding that we all organize with her and call for an audit of the mayoral control procedures before we renew and extend mayoral control. So, Sister Audrey, thank you again. We know you've been busy, and we appreciate you hanging in there.
Thank you, Sister Betty. Yes, good evening, Sister Betty, Brother Ralph, and all of those on the panel and the listening audience. I just want to come today as someone representing the New York Coalition to finally end mayor control. But before I tell you what the message is from them, I just want to say I heard today on the Inside City Hall in New York One that this weekend the mayor, Eric Adams, was in Albany, and he is supposed to have made a deal to extend mayoral control for 2 more years. He is not happy with that, the reporter is saying, and so they did call the office, and no response was given to the reporter today. So at any rate, we are still pushing to end mayoral control, because this weekend, on Friday, they're planning to deliberate in the assembly to think about giving him this for sure. And so John Liu was very instrumental in helping this mayor to get 2 years deal. So we're still hoping that he's not going to get it. So this message from the New York City Coalition says, mayoral control handcuffs our school communities and leaves us powerless in the decisions made for our children. Parents, students, teachers, and community call for a full audit, which they have not done, of mayoral control 2002 to present. So these politicians are not listening to us, but we have to be steadfast and ask the question, what are policymakers afraid of uncovering and or disclosing to us, the public? Mayoral control on the ballot now. If Chicago voters can be trusted to exercise democracy on mayoral control and school governance, why can't New York City voters be trusted as well? No to commissions about us, without us. Representative rights holders, parents, students, educators, and the community must be equal say, not just this mayor or any other mayor. Members of any and all task forces or commissions on schools. New York City Coalition to finally end mayoral control. Please join the resistance at the 3w.nycmayoralcontrolnot.org. I thank you. Thank you.
Say that one more. Your website.
The website is www.nycmayoralcontrol, mayoralcontrol.org. So there is still a chance, Brother Ralph and Sister Betty, for the communities to rise up and let their politicians know not to give this mayor, not one, not two, nothing. He cannot handle it. So we need to recall this mayor because he's not doing what the people had sent him there to do when he was campaigning, going to their doors, knocking, and asking for their votes. We don't want him to be in control. Because what they're saying, too, class size should be reduced, and I think that is why he's not responding to the reporter, because he knows now that he has to give up some funds, which he does not want to give up. Thank you again.
Thank you so much for that. And there's so much to deal with on and public and private, so-called private education, the charter schools. We have a fight on our hands, and we want to bring information to you about the largest lawsuit ever won in the state of New York. It was won by the teachers of New York City, but you never hear it. Nobody talks about it, and we're going to, in future programs, be talking more about it and have people on, and we're going to also be talking about the organization of the teachers' union. Can you imagine Starbucks has the sense to organize and have a union?
Yes.
Some of our teachers in the charter schools do not. That has to be dealt with, and we as the public must make sure that this issue comes up, and we must support the organizing of teachers in charter schools, because how is it that we have the teachers teaching the same students in many of the same buildings, many of the buildings that are redone for the benefit and the profit of those owners of the building, and yet the teachers are working overtime, extended years into the summer, starting early, and they do not have a union. This is constitutional rights of those. Sister Betty.
Okay, before we go to Brother Dennis, we want to call on one of our usual contributors. And Sister Audrey, you are awesome, but I think you also belong to another organization that's very active in the community. Are there any announcements you want to make about that one?
Yes, the Student Improvement Association, under the auspices of the Universal Negro Improvement Association, they have been plunging forward to file a lawsuit against the Department of Education for incompetent leadership in our district. And as you see, the chancellor, he is recalling all these superintendents to have them reapply for their jobs, which is awful because he's replacing these superintendents with his cronies. And so it's another corruption, Sister Betty.
Well, thank you so much for that. And it would be wonderful if we could pull all of these organizations with just complaints together to overturn not only the system in Washington, the system in Albany, but the system in New York. Thank you so much for that. And Sister Betty.
All right. We're going to we've got some heavy hitters in the audience tonight. So please hang in there with us. Brother Joel, your mic is open. But I also want to make an announcement. Jericho doesn't just unite to support political prisoners. New York City Jericho's website has been putting out some fantastic articles on what's going on with education. And I think, you know, shortly after, before the program closes, if Sister Ann can hang in there with us, if she could just identify some of the articles that she has been out there warning us in terms of education and where they're going and what they're planning. Thank you again, Sister Audrey Dennis. Without further ado, Joel, your mic is open. And Brother Dennis, hang in there. Thank you for your patience. We look forward to your comments.
Joel, your mic is open. Joel, we see you're with us. All right, Joel, we're going to have to move on. We're going to leave your mic open. If you see a sign or something, just barge right in. That's Sister Betty.
All right, Brother Dennis. Once again, thank you for waiting. Mic is open.
My heart is heavy, like everyone on the call. First of all, I'd like to say the African Liberation Day was very successful here and abroad on the 27th, 28th, and 29th of this past weekend. Africans in Liberia were massing people, uniting for African internationalism for both here and abroad, as well as in Philly, as well as in California, St. Louis, areas of the country. We are strengthening. We are gaining. We had youth involved, had drummers. Matter of fact, Sister Lisa Davis, with her powerful self, was out there spawning on. I must say that on a good note. Now for the sad news. Who killed Huey? Don't tell no lie. It was the government. The government, the FBI. Again, who killed Huey? Don't tell no lie. It was the government. The government, the FBI. That was a chant that the Chairman O'Malley Yeshitela had ranted previously back in 1989 after the murder of Huey P. Newton, who they tried to really defame, tried to demoralize when this man was a king among men. I say that when 18-year-old Grendon planned and murdered African skin to the note of 10 in Buffalo, New York, Grendon came out of the Topps food store with his hands up and was gently arrested. I observed the imperialist forces chuckling and outright laughing at the deceased lying limp on the ground. This is what we faced. While in Grand Rapids, Patrick Loyola's killer, sure, is still off the hook, which simply means there is no intent. This man executed this young man in the back of the head, shot him in the back of the head, face down. There is no intent by government to make a difference, to hold people accountable for the brutal murders of black skin. Just last week, police shoot pregnant black woman 5 times while she's getting out of a car, accused of carjacking, but she was a pregnant sister. She came out with her hands up. They shot her 5 times. A black pregnant 26-year-old named Leona Hale was shot 5 times by Kansas City police, despite being apparently unarmed and having her hands up. Then when they shot her while she's bleeding out, carrying a child, they handcuffed her while she was on the ground. There is no change with this thing that we deal with. There is no change with a beast. There is no change that will happen. These people used to eat black bodies. This is what we deal with in colonialism, imperialism, and capitalism that is material. There is no change and no shame. I want to allude to real quick a brief read, and then I will move on and pass it on. We all remember the Algiers Motel incident. You all remember that?
Yes, we do.
Algiers Motel incident, also called the Algiers Motel murders, occurred in Detroit, Michigan, in the United States throughout the night of July 25th and 26th of 1967 during a racially charged 12th Street riot at the Algiers Motel, approximately 1 mile east of where the riot began. 3 civilians were killed and 9 others abused by a riot task force composed of the Detroit Police Department, the Michigan State Police, the Michigan Army National Guard, and this is also some paratroopers that were involved. Among the casualties were 3 black teenage boys killed and 2 white women and 7 black men wounded as a result. The task force was searching the area after reports were received that a gunman or a group of gunmen, possibly snipers, had been seen at or near the motel. You knew that was a lie. They were just patrons of the motel. The mistake, these men were dealing with young white women. That was the albatross. One death has never been explained, as the body was allegedly found by responding officers. Two deaths have been attributed to justifiable homicide or self-defense. Charges of felonious assault, conspiracy, murder, and conspiracy to commit civil rights abuse were filed against three officers. Charges of assault and conspiracy were also filed on a private security guard. All were found not guilty. This is a repeat, and a repeat that is perpetual. And we need to understand that our fight is not trying to combine with, I look at, as the brother mentioned and the sister mentioned, here's Sundiata Okoli, 85 years old. It's a sad. Now released just to die. You talked about Lynn Stewart, just released just to die. These were freedom fighters, powerful freedom fighters. Did no wrong, shot nobody up, just spoke truth to power. And this is the injustice or injustice that we receive perpetually, always. I listened to the brother, and I will be quiet, someone else wants to come on. At the border, men and women whipped by men on horses. Then under Biden, the very next day sent back to Haiti to a death situation. Just 2 weeks ago, two Haitian boats observed, sank, and everyone on board those two little boats died. Nobody went to save our brothers and sisters. We must see the time, and we must understand that the things that we do to each other has to cease. Young man, young woman, I say, stop shooting one another. Save your bullets. They are out to disarm you and really are quite glad that you and I would have this hatred towards ourselves. It lessens their work, but right now they're on the rampage, and this bloodbath is escalating. We must be prepared, and I say the time is now. Join us Sunday. I'm going to say America on Trial. This is Omadi taught me on Sunday morning, which will be June the 5th, on Omadi taught me, which is on the Burning Spirit TV or Uhuru TV on YouTube. 9 o'clock p.m. or a.m. Central Time, 7 a.m. Pacific Time, 10 a.m. Eastern Time. Please join us. Omadi taught me, America on Trial. The verdict is in. Reparations now. Uhuru.
Uhuru, freedom. Thank you for that report, Brother Dennis. And we always look for the wonderful information you bring us on this program. And the program is called What's Happening, and you surely are up on what's happening. Thanks again. It is archived, my brothers and sisters. We can re-listen over and over again as I do, because, as I say, I'm learning so much. Sister Betty.
All right, we're going to try it one more time for Brother Joel. Brother Joel, your mic is open.
Yes, I think I can be heard now. I called back. I think the connection is better.
Can
people hear me?
Much.
Okay,
yes,
great. I'm really glad for the opportunity to be heard here and to hear all of the really enlightened and incomparable discussion that takes place in this forum. I want to say that we're just coming off another week with a major shooting, this one in Texas. It seems that the intensification of the mass killings of innocent people are increasing in frequency and also in the toll of the people being killed. And, of course, the remedy that the ruling class is coming up with is, again, the idea that that people should, that there should be more control over guns, that the government should decide who can have a gun and who can't have a gun, so that in the end, the police and the military and all of the other repressive organs of the state will be armed like never before, and people will be disarmed, not only by having guns that are needed by the oppressed for self-defense banned, but at the same time, it not only disarms people physically and martially, it also disarms people's mentality when we don't think of the fact that we're all at gunpoint and increasingly under attack. I think this started intensifying, especially with what, to me, I don't know if everybody agrees with this, but the COVID as a lab-produced, U.S.-financed germ warfare to begin to destroy the health of the population. And we see this is still running at pace, that nothing really effective is being done to stop or slow down the pandemic. But we also have this combined with the episodes. This is like an ongoing chronic taking of a mass number of lives, and it's combined with the episodes of acute things like the mass shootings that have taken place. Now, it turns out that certain very fishy things have taken place around all three of these murders, the one in Brooklyn, the one in Buffalo, and the one in Texas. And, for example, in Texas, it is being heavily noted that the police waited outside of the building while the gunfire could be heard. Nobody went in, and they basically knew what room everything was taking place in. They could have gone into the building, surrounded the room, and done something to disrupt the steady progress of killing. But they waited, some people say 49 minutes, others say an hour. And it turned out that some border control agents that weren't under direct orders are the ones that actually went in first after the police discouraged them from going in. They apparently heard about the confrontation, and they arrived to do what they thought would be to help the police put an end to it. And instead, they were discouraged, and they were the ones that went in way ahead of any of the police and stopped the or did what they could to bring it to a stop. And then we know also in the Brooklyn shooting that the person doing the shooting got away. Apparently, the police took a long time to arrive after people were calling 911 on their cell phones, so that the shooter got away, and and it turned out also that the security and surveillance cameras at the station were all malfunctioning, very similar to what happened in the supposed suicide of Jeffrey Epstein, who, if you remember, he was on suicide watch. There were two guards that were supposed to be watching his cell. Both of them say that they fell asleep at the same time on their shift. And also, the cameras that were trained on that cell were also malfunctioning and not working and ineffective. And somehow, the way in which Jeffrey Epstein whatever state he met was hidden from any view, even from the official view. The other thing in Buffalo also, the police went in and they stood around while the shooting continued. And it just seems that there's a pattern of malfunctions that don't really make any sense, especially when you look at it at three at the same time. So a lot of things are presented as this lunatic or that lunatic, or I shouldn't just say lunatic, which is sort of neutral, but these this racist lunatic in Buffalo or this other lunatic that killed all these Hispanics stood around. They want us to think that all of this is either just completely coincidental that it's even happening, or that it's just based on certain people that are fanatical ideologists about race that strike out. And it doesn't seem to be much in the way of investigating whether these instances are coordinated. Like many of the mass shooters have psychiatric histories, which means that they come into contact with the state through its psychiatric wing, as well as through its wing of people that have been imprisoned for riotous acts. And it's a way of collecting people that are on the point of violent acts, and with a certain amount of encouragement, support, brainwashing, and manipulation can be pushed over the top to do it. And then the suggestion is, well, if only we had gun control, that would prevent any of these from happening. But the whole gun control idea is anticipating the time when there will be a confrontation of the masses of people against the tiny elite that run this country through the political networks that brainwash and mislead us all through the media, that a revolutionary situation will develop, and the weakness of the revolutionary side would be that they have been trained, especially by the Democratic Party and the more liberal forces in gun control and in inhibition about either possessing or knowing how to use guns, both as individuals and in groups, when it will be necessary to defend for people, the masses of people, to defend themselves against a government which is growing into a more and more undisguised tyranny. It's always been a tyranny because it's really a handful of bankers that call all the important shots in the government on reflection, pun intended there. And so far, it's been a one-sided war in which the potentially revolutionary masses of working people, especially those who are racially oppressed, have been at least ideologically disarmed and are not thinking in terms of the revolution that the country needs. And I want to say it's not like somebody would be looking for violent revolution or anything like that, but to make the revolution as peaceful as possible, the self-defense of the people that would be targeted by the tyranny would have to have as strong a self-defense as possible, and would have to anticipate the increasing repression that's coming down right now from the police state, and the behind-the-scenes coordination of seemingly singular or only indirectly related acts, that these things could be coordinated in one way or another. And like I say, this, the intelligence forces and the political police in this country have a whole collection of thousands of people that can be pushed over the top indirectly and sent into this kind of an action, with the government pretending that, we tried to stop this stuff, and if only you people had gone along with gun control, it never would have happened. But we see that we know that we have to defend ourselves, defend our rights, and we have to remember that we wouldn't even have the promises that are contained in the Bill of Rights if not for what happened at Lexington and Concord. And I don't mean to not also include all the other contributions that were made by all the oppressed people in this country, from the native peoples that have been subject to continual genocide and are still generation after generation living in reservations that are really concentration camps, so-called reservations, and of course, centuries of racial slavery and the aftermath of it in terms of Jim Crow discrimination, oppressive segregation, and so on. To build, we have to build solidarity across all of these lines. We have to unite, and increasingly we have to say, because it reflects the reality, that we can't really take it anymore. We need a new system that's based on human needs rather than corporate profits extracted from people all over the world, pinning us each and all against each other. And that's why we have this program which concentrates on political prisoners who have paid a strong price for making the call towards that kind of solidarity.
Well, thanks again for that, Joe. It's a wonderful presentation. I will listen to that again. And when we talk about gun control, there will never be gun control in America for two reasons. One, because we have to understand the role of guns in America and maintaining what America is, and the way that they go after the gun control is from the back door. And the people no longer have trust in the government, because the people on the right do not trust the government. The people on the left do not trust the government, and rightfully so. The government has not earned the trust of the people. And it is said many, many years ago, the people should not be afraid of the government. The government should be afraid of the people. We're beginning it to get there, but there is a problem that must be sorted out, and we must discuss the whole idea of gun control. And always remember that the gun control will not be for white Americans. Gun control will be for black Americans. And one of the things we started off the program, what is the relationship between gun control, crack cocaine legislation, the Rockefeller laws? They took the young people that were potential resistors of this government off the streets. As Kwesi Balogun once said to me many years ago, Kwesi Balogun, our great revolutionary, he said, "Ralph, go to the Bronx and clean up a lot, because if you get 10 kids to help you, one of those 10 is going to be a revolutionary. And so clean up every lot in the Bronx. And by the time you finish cleaning up the lot, you might have an army." And so, yes, there is a connection. We must remember those connections. We must remember the government's relationship to the people. And I will conclude with, the struggle continues, and I look forward to hearing people tomorrow evening, 8 o'clock, 99.5 on your FM dial. Please call in and give the contribution that you have given to this program, to the listening, the radio listening program of 99.5 FM, because they too are in great trouble. They need people to listen, to understand, and to support the public radio. On that note, I say, Sister Betty.
Sister Ann, I don't want to put you on the spot, but I've noticed that from time to time you've had some interesting alerts on the website about education. Did you want to make an announcement about just one of them? Give us the name of just one article, or we can come back with that.
One of the recent ones I did send out was the Unseen and Unknown and Untold History Following the Brown v. Board of Education decision. So now you're going all the way back to 1954, right? But
yes.
The white backlash against that wasn't only just all those people who now don't want their children to know that they were spitting and hitting and cursing at black and brown people going to school. They also got rid of thousands and thousands of African-American teachers who were more qualified, many of them, than the white teachers who replaced them, because heaven forfend that these white kids should be taught by people of color. And it's an amazing long article. It was in Politico. You can find it at politico.com. And it goes into a lot of detail and talks about what is the loss of generational wealth also since that time, when you had all these professionals who could no longer practice their profession and could no longer teach. And these are things that, you know, it is sort of like an untold story. And one of the interesting things about that New York Times series on Haiti that we were talking about earlier was that they made it very clear that here's a nation that freed itself from slavery and then had to pay their former enslavers reparations. And that's why Haiti is in the economic crisis that it is, because they were paying reparations to France.
Well, thank you so much for that, Anne. Very important, my brothers and sisters. Look forward to hearing you next week. And do not forget tomorrow, 99.5 on your FM dial, 8 p.m. Please call in. Please support public radio, because without that, we are in great trouble. Thank you and good night.
Say them loud, say them clear, for the whole wide world to hear. I wish I could share all the love that's in my heart. Remove all the thoughts that keep.